Streaming 24/7.
Oh my God, it's better than I thought.
This is Radio Influence.
Let me tell you why you're here.
You have 210 stories.
What truth?
Office buildings.
We just witnessed some kind of...
You don't find a desk.
Secondary.
You don't find a chair.
Follow-up explosion on the World Trade Center.
You don't find a telephone.
Some kind of explosion. A lot of smoke come out of the top.
110 stories high. They are no longer there.
The building collapsed to dust.
To dust. To dust. To dust. To dust. To dust. To dust. This is your last chance.
I would ask.
After this, there is no turning back.
Once all the facts are out.
You take the blue pill.
For your understanding.
The story ends.
And for your forgiveness.
You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want.
Media is the...
You take the red
pill. Nervous system of a democracy.
You stay in Wonderland.
If it's not functioning well, the democracy can't function.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
The democracy red can't pill. Function.
The red pill.
Take the red pill.
You have to let it all go.
Take the red pill.
Fear.
9/11truth.org.
Doubt.
WhatReallyHappened.com.
You disbelieve.
WTC7.net.
Free your mind.
Take the red pill.
I'm ready to do this. Are you ready? Do you take your red pill with a shot? Do you, like, drink it down? Do you just swallow it dry? The only reason you're going to listen to this podcast is because you're tired of being bullshitted and you've come to understand the fact that a lot of what you're told is... It's not just bullshit, it's aromatic bullshit. It's the kind of bullshit that you can smell when the wind's blowing in your direction. I grew up in a small town in Connecticut, and they used to use cow shit as fertilizer, and you could always tell when they were spreading it. And I go, man, they're fertilizing the fields. Well, the mainstream media is, they're good at it. They're great at it. And that's why Dangerous Conversation exists. That's why this show's always been around. And connecting the dots is sometimes easy because the internet affords me to go back in time and look at, just wait until you hear the audio I'm going to play you today. We're going to talk a little bit about the Clinton Foundation. Everything's so warm and fuzzy. You know, globalism. And it's like, oh, all the children of different nations and nationalities are all going to hold hands and sing kumbaya fucking ya. Well, they're not. That's not what globalism is. Globalism is giant corporations going, what? They've got lithium? They've got titanium? Well, let's just go there and take their shit. You can't just do that. You have to have a reason to invade Iraq, Afghanistan, Sudan. Yeah. Because it's warm and fuzzy. So, welcome to Dangerous Conversation. I'm Ledge. Appreciate you hanging out. Always share this podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at LedgeDCRadio. You can follow me on Facebook, Scott, with my original spelling the way my parents intended it, L-E-G-E-R-E. And, of course, Dangerous Conversation. Hang on a second. I have a hair in my tongue. Dangerous Conversation on Facebook, too. And without further ado, I got the fan going in here. It's hot out. I mean, what are we looking at? It's like September 28th, and it's still pretty damn hot. We're waiting for that cold snap. Supposed to get one. So far, the dental surgery nightmare continues. Basically, I had some teeth removed, you know, the old wisdom teeth. Well, shards of bone, if you listened to the show a couple of weeks ago, keep being ejected through my gum line. Infection ensues. Then I have to take an antibiotic. That gives me the shits. And the nightmare continues. So I found out that while on these antibiotics, I can't really drink beer because it just, well... makes it worse. So tonight, I'm doing rum and cokes.
tasty.
All right, let's get right to it. A lot of times I've posted this clip. A lot of times I've talked about this clip. A lot of times I've played this clip. And it is so foretelling as to not only what happened in the past, but what is currently happening. Syria, Libya not too long ago. And you go like, well, that was Bush and Cheney. That's just the actors on the right versus the actors on the left. The actors on the left are in control now. And we'll get to, well, Hillary and their foundation. And it's like hundreds of billions of dollars of fuzziness. Like, oh, we have a foundation. It's so warm and welcoming. No, it's how you channel bribes to third world nations. So that dictator that you support that's chopping the heads off of people will look the other way when you come in with your big mining machines and you sell those rights to the, that's what your foundation's all about. We'll hear from Glenn Greenwald. We'll hear from quite a bit of audio here today. I want to play you a bit of, I got to know which pecking order. You know, I'm going to do the Coney audio before I do the Clinton Foundation. But I'm going, again, go back to Wesley Clark, where he talks about the memo of the United States pre-planned invasions of 7 countries in 5 years. Okay, I'm going to stop and start a lot of audio, but stay with me here. We're going to not just connect the dots, we're going to show you that that PNAC plan, the Project for the New American Century, we're going to hear Leslie Visser talk to a whistleblower, Paul O'Neill. And then, of course, we'll see that the plan way back in 2000, when PNAC wrote that document, before 9/11 took place, before the boogeyman of Saddam Hussein, I'm sorry, Osama bin Laden. How's that for a fucking Freudian slip? So let's start with Wesley Clark. Let's make sure we got him potted up here, and here we go.
Days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon.
Started from the beginning.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon, and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who used to work for me.
If you're familiar with this clip, hang with me. I get it. But, you know, a lot of times people are going to sit there and go, I've heard this, but okay, yeah, they kind of had some plans. Yeah, well, we're going to connect the dots for you today, okay?
One of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September.
Okay, that's 10 days after 9/11.
I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments."
It's not about 9/11. And even Wesley Clark, towards the end of this, talks about the coup within the United States government. In other words, he calls it a policy coup.
And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years.
PNAC, the Project for the New American Century, basically came out of there's no more boogeyman with Russia, late 80s, early 90s. Two things were taking place. One, the military-industrial complex needed an enemy to keep building weapons, to keep the Department of Defense funded, to keep the Pentagon funded. If you don't have an enemy and you're not sending cruise missiles anywhere, you don't get any new ones. Works the same way in some logistics of some local government. If you don't use enough sand and salt on the roads in New England during the winter, you don't get as much money allocated the following year. So part of this is the military-industrial complex. The most of it is simply about the strategic part of the Middle East. It is loaded with natural gas and oil. It's landlocked in the Caspian Basin. We'll get to that when we talk about Syria a little later. People go, oh, you know, Assad's a bad man. He used chemical weapons. Doesn't that sound familiar? Who else used chemical weapons? Oh, yeah. The dude in Iraq. So the truth is, PNAC knew, if you're going to run the world, you need energy to run the world. And if you're going to lock it up, it means you need to have military bases around it. And the only way to do that is to invade these seven countries. And they had a five-year plan, which, of course, took a lot longer. So it's, some of it is about selling weapons and keeping the military funded. Most of it is about the strategic ownership or claiming or conquering of the most energy-condensed place on the planet, the Middle East.
Starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon.
Iraq, Syria, Lebanon.
Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and
Finland. Man, he goes so fast. I wish I could stop that.
Countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq.
Okay, Iraq. We blame them directly for 9/11.
And then Syria, Lebanon.
Syria, Lebanon. Syria is the big conflict right now. That's what Gary Johnson didn't know what Aleppo was. That's the new one.
Lebanon, Libya.
Libya. Okay, I got to back it up again because we're going to talk about Africa here and Hillary Clinton and the foundation. I just want to make sure you know these seven countries are all playing out exactly the way PNAC needed them to happen. Not in a chronological order or an order of importance, but the whole idea is they were all strategically important for some reason. One had the natural gas and oil. The other one had the land to run the pipeline to the Mediterranean. That's Syria. That's what that's about. We'll hear, you know, it's again, it's not about Assad and chemical weapons. It's about PNAC, Project for the New American Century. I'm going to let this play. Here we go. Here's your countries.
Out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
Okay, here's a speech he's given now. You got to remember, this guy, it's kind of funny. When you talk about Wesley Clark, people go, oh, he's just a, you know, people always attack the messenger. They'll always go after the messenger. Oh, he's been proven this. And what's happened? Look at everything that's taken place. He's absolutely right. He's not, he wasn't guys spreading bullshit. They're spreading shit. He's not that guy. He's just one of those guys who thought, you know, and you're going to hear this, and it's only about 90 seconds left in this one, and you're going to hear him say, you know, I'm a general, part of an army, the greatest country in the world, most powerful. I thought our army was about A, and it turns out it's about B. And that's why he spoke out.
The truth is about the Middle East is, had there been no oil there, it would be like Africa. Nobody is threatening to intervene in Africa.
Not exactly true. More minerals in Africa than oil. Remember now, lithium, titanium. So Africa obviously has strategic, you know, Sudan, that's Africa. And again, later in the program, we're gonna talk about Hillary, Syria, and the Clinton Foundation.
The problem is the opposite. We keep asking for people to intervene and stop it. And there's no question that the presence of petroleum throughout the region has sparked great power involvement. Whether that was the specific motivation for the coup or not, I can't tell you. But there was definitely...
This is a general calling the United States actions a coup. Let that sink in. Smedley Butler did the same thing about 100 years before this guy.
There's always been this attitude that somehow we could intervene and use force in the region. And we had instead a policy coup in this country, a coup, a policy coup. Some hard-nosed people took over the direction of American policy, and they never bothered to inform the rest of us. And he said, I just want to tell you, he said, nobody's going to tell us where or when we can bomb. Nobody.
He's referring to Rumsfeld there.
A pretty stunning thing. You mean... The purpose of the military is to start wars and change governments. It's not to sort of deter conflict.
We're going to invade countries. And, I my mind was spinning. And I put that aside. It was like a nugget that you hold on to. This country was taken over by a group of people with a policy coup.
Now, remember, if you're only referring to, you know, quote, Republicans or the neocons, and you go, okay, well, once Barack Obama came in, that coup would have been reversed, correct? Well, what if the people on the left are just, you know, it's like wrestling. Good guy, good guy. Okay, you guys are the bad guys now. Later on, we're going to be the bad guys. You'll be the good guys. And it's this coup wasn't just Republicans or neocons or the Bush administration. We'll get to that. That's what I'm talking about here. This our direction, this country's direction, not the American people, the country's corporatization or corporatocracy, that direction has not been detoured. This is a man who spent his entire career in the military thinking we're the good guys. And now he's realizing that we're not.
Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld, and you could name a half dozen other collaborators from the Project for a New American Century.
The powers of transformation. Even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic or catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor. The PNAC document literally states they need for all of this to take place, they needed a new Pearl Harbor.
They wanted us to destabilize the Middle East, turn it upside down. Make it under our control. They could hardly wait to finish Iraq so they could move into Syria.
This speech was October 3rd of 2007. Thank you, Wesley Clark, for speaking out. I'm sure your life, I'm sure family members have been threatened. I'm sure all kinds of, you know. All right, let's move. See, let's just start with 9/11 2001. And if we move forward and Bush goes, we go like, well, prove Iraq had anything to do with 9/11. Most of the people know now it was Saudi-backed and funded by Turkey and or Pakistan. And the people that look into this see the man behind the curtain. Well, here's an old story from 60 Minutes back when they weren't muzzled about Paul O'Neill, another whistleblower. Check out what Leslie, and by the way, whoever produced this video got 43,000 views. Thank you. But they, I have to have, they put these little dramatic music stingers in there like boom, boom, boom. So when you hear that, just know that's not me. Okay, here we go.
A year ago, Paul O'Neill was fired from his job as George Bush's Treasury Secretary for disagreeing too many times with the president's policy on tax cuts. Tonight, O'Neill, who is known for speaking his mind, talks for the first time about his 2 years inside the Bush administration. His story is the centerpiece of a new book being published this week about the way the Bush White House is run. Entitled The Price of Loyalty, the book, by a former Wall Street Journal reporter, draws on interviews with high-level officials who gave the author their personal accounts of meetings with the president, their notes and documents. But the main source of the book was Paul O'Neill. Paul O'Neill says he's going public because he thinks the Bush administration has been too secretive about how decisions have been made.
This is a 2004 60 Minutes piece, by the way.
Contrary to how we practice politics today in this country, there is some market for the truth.
You interviewed how many?
Ron Suskind, very famous author, is the actual author, of course. Of this book.
Many other people.
Oh, hundreds of people.
Hundreds.
Hundreds of people.
How many other cabinet members?
Several. Let's just say several.
But O'Neill is the only one who spoke on the record. Didn't someone in this administration, high up, call him on the phone and warn him not to do this book?
Yes.
And who was it?
Don Rumsfeld.
And what happened at President Bush's very first National Security Council meeting is one of O'Neill's most startling revelations.
I'm sorry, but those stingers crack me up. It's like Scooby-Doo. There's more of them. Oh, goody.
In the very beginning, there was a conviction that Saddam Hussein was a bad person and that he needed to go.
He says that going after Saddam Hussein was topic A 10 days after the inauguration.
All right, since 9/11 happened a year and 9 months into Bush's reign, how is it 10 days after the inauguration that Saddam Hussein needs to be... Wait a minute. Oh, yeah, the PNAC plan. Iraq is going to be first. But we'll need a new Pearl Harbor. Just remember that. 10 days after Bush is in office, he's sitting with cabinet members telling them...
After Saddam Hussein was topic A 10 days after the inauguration, 8 months before September 11th.
8 months. That's right.
From the very first instance, it was about Iraq. It was about what we can do to change this regime.
Now, everybody else thought that grew out of 9/11.
No.
But this book says it was day one of this administration.
Day one, these things were laid and sealed.
Okay. It was Saddam Hussein, you meddling kids. All right, I'm sorry. But I know you're trying to make, you know, I always say this about people that produce videos, and I end up using some of them during the podcast. And I'm awesome that you, I think it's awesome you gathered this old 60 Minutes piece and you prove, you literally prove that the administration and, you know, I think of Bush's cabinet, I think 10 members of his cabinet actually signed the PNAC document. That was when Clinton was still in office. So they were like, here's the new America, the project for the new American century. Take over the oil reserves, military bases in the Middle East, keep the military machine, you know, multiple theaters, multiple wars. It's about a 100-page document if you read the PNAC document. It's got some pretty pictures in it, too, all kinds of high-tech fighters that they wanted to sell. So here we are 8 months before 9/11. And we have a whistleblower, of course, in 2004 saying, no, this was all planned. This is before the towers fell. This was before we had a, what was it? Failure of imagination. That's why 9/11 was successful for 19 guys with box cutters.
As Treasury Secretary, O'Neill was a permanent member of the National Security Council. He says in the book he was surprised at the meeting that questions such as why Saddam and why now were never asked. It's all about finding a way to do it. That was the tone of it. The president saying, go find me a way to do this.
We need to take out Iraq. We can't just go stomp on their head. You have to remember, if you go back to his daddy, early 90s, Bush won and Iraq won, we have the famous incubator baby story, where someone testifies that the Iraqis invaded Kuwait and they were leaving babies in incubators to die on the floor. And, of course, later on we find out that's the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter who was actually trained at a pub. I know. This is so fucking wag the dog. It is. I can't beat people over the head with this. I have to actually just show them this shit. And just have, they just get a blank expression because everything they think, oh, well, you know, we're fighting the terrorists and, you know, it's a, you know, we're America and we're the good guys and we wear the hat. And no, we're an empire and we needed to come up with a reason to invade an oil rich country and we just couldn't do it. You and I wouldn't just stand by if we just invaded a country. Wait a minute. We do all the time now. We'll get to Libya later and the dinar. We'll get to Syria later and the pipelines. We're just sitting around watching this plan going, well, America, fuck yeah.
For me, the notion of a preemption that the U.S. has the unilateral right to do whatever we decide to do is a really huge leap
And that came up on, at this first meeting.
It did.
O'Neill told us the discussion of Iraq continued at the next National Security Council meeting 2 days later. He got briefing materials under this cover sheet.
There are memos. One of them, marked secret, says, plan for post-Saddam Iraq.
8 months before 9/11. 8 months before 9/11. The last podcast, I played you Lucky Larry. Larry Silverstein, who owned Building 7, who went to his designers and said, build me or design me a new Building 7 16 months before 9/11. Fucking fifth graders could figure this shit out.
Nation building.
Absolutely.
So they discussed an occupation of Iraq.
In January and February of 2001.
Based on his interviews with O'Neill and several other officials at the meetings, Susskind writes that the planning envisioned peacekeeping troops, war crimes tribunals, and even divvying up Iraq's oil wealth.
Sorry. I just picture them like ripping the rubber mask off of Bush's face or something. You know, I'm glad someone found this old news piece, but yeah, I warned you ahead of time.
I obtained this Pentagon document dated March 5, 2001, entitled Foreign Suitors for Iraqi Oil Field Contracts.
They were already talking to different oil companies across the globe about how they're going to slice up the Iraqi oil pie 6 months before 9/11. You still think it's the Islamic terrorists? Remember 9/11? All those fucking propaganda pieces we see and flag waving and jets flying over football games and people crying. When will this shit permeate your brain? When? How much information do you need before you're going to go, okay, I've been bullshitted. I admit it. I finally have come to terms with the fact that all of it is bullshit. When's that going to happen? Because I know the people that listen to this podcast on a regular basis, most of you already have accepted that. But the ones that are new to the show, the ones that go, oh, yeah, you know, you're just another conspiracy theorist. How much information do you need? Old man, amusement park, guilty. I can just smell the bullshit in the air.
It includes a map of potential areas for exploration.
It talks about contractors around the world from, you know, 30, 40 countries, and which ones have what intentions or...
On oil
in Iraq.
During the campaign... Candidate Bush had criticized the Clinton-Gore administration for being too interventionist.
Oh, good cop, bad cop. See? He's running for president. Now, of course, Clinton's in office. And we had Bosnia, which, by the way, had everything to do with Russia and their oil. Ugh. God. Ugh. Listen to this. This cracks me up.
If we don't stop extending our troops all around the world... and nation-building missions, then we're going to have a serious problem coming down the road, and I'm going to prevent that.
The president had just run a campaign about being humble and not engaging in nation-building.
The thing that's most surprising, I think, is how emphatically, from the very first, this administration had said X during the campaign, but from the first day was often doing Y, not just saying Y, but actively moving toward the opposite of what they had said during the election.
Minus the disco music, a great little piece there. And again, remember, it starts with Wesley Clark. Remember?
This is a book that talks about the Kosovo campaign. And he said, I just want to tell you, he said, nobody's going to tell us where or when we can bomb. Nobody. He said, I'm thinking of calling this a floating coalition. What do you think about that? I said, well, sir, thanks for reading my book. And, well, he said, thanks. That's all the time I've got.
Yeah, I know. I don't get into 3-minute conversations with people that are politically driven on the liberal side or Democratic or whatever they call it, or conservative or Republican, because they don't want to look at evidence. And there is so much evidence. I mean, you have a PNAC document. I've said this so many times on my podcast that it's like literally the Patriots are playing the Cowboys and the Cowboys get their playbook and just look through it and go, oh, okay. Well, that's what the Project for the New American Century documents, a PDF. It's all over the internet. Go read it. Remember, it was written in 99/2000. None of those people were in power because Clinton was still in power. So they all come into power, ironically, and look what happens. So now let's remember what those 7 countries were. It wasn't just Iraq and Afghanistan. It was also Iran, by the way, which somehow we've come to terms with. So I'm sure there's some shady-ass business going on the backside of that. But let's kind of fast forward a little bit to Libya. Now, Libya was a few years back, and many people, again, is the running theme, Assad's a bad man, Saddam Hussein's a bad man, and now let's talk Libya. We'll play this piece about Libya here in a second. And, of course, who? Muammar Gaddafi. All these bad, evil dictators. By the way, the standard of living in Libya was off the charts because they had so much gold and oil that even though the dictator, and when we talk about the Clinton Foundation, you're going to find about the African dictators that we now know of and how the Clintons have decided a more secretive way of funneling money to those people so they take over using guerrillas and terrorism in their own countries, on their own people. So the mineral rights are later on sold to the big countries coming in. That'll be the last part of what we're doing here as we connect the dots. But let's do Libya next because it's a no-brainer. Back in 73, actually, if you go back to the 60s, the Federal Reserve and the bankers just started printing a ton of money and giving it and or loaning it to other countries because the American dollar was very strong. And even though it was gold-backed, and it was obviously the reserve currency of the United States of America, but as well as across the globe, it was the dominant currency. In 73, I believe it was France, comes to us and goes, you know, all this money we have is just paper. We'd like some of that gold back that that's ours in your banks. Well, if you go all the way back to the beginning of how money was invented, it really started with blacksmiths. Blacksmiths were actually the first gold reservists. In other words, if you were some rich person, you'd want to drive through the woods and have all your gold on you. Some robber would steal it from you, kill you, murder you. So the first banks were invented way, way back. We're talking 1400, 1300, where the blacksmith would say, okay, you give me your 100 pounds of gold or your 10 pounds of gold, and we'll write they were called drafts. They were the first checks. In other words, I could write you a piece of paper that said, I'm going to give you $200, but it's a piece of paper because my gold is safely in a bank. Very first banks. Well, what happens? You got 100 pounds of gold in there, and next thing you know, you're writing out checks. The blacksmith's going like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And essentially the same thing, the same way the Fed works now, we're going to put way more than 100 pounds of gold worth of money in checks. And I think it was on the average about 10% of the people would come back and say, okay, well, I want my gold back. So the blacksmiths were the first bankers. Now you fast forward all the way to the 60s, same thing. We're just printing money off a money machine. We don't give a shit whether it's backed by gold or not. France comes to us in 72 and goes, we want our gold back. Well, yeah, we got a little problem. So what does Nixon do? Basically, the gold reserves did not even come close to the actual money in circulation. They were printing money that was backed by nothing. So Nixon takes us off the gold standard.
Well, now technically your money's not worth anything. It's not backed by anything. In comes the petrodollar. The petrodollar was based on all the oil companies of the world selling their oil in dollars. Oil's real. It's a real energy source. It's obviously very vital and important. We're going to have the dollar backed by oil. The invention of the petrodollar. Now, that's in 72, 73. So now you come all the way fast forward. Gaddafi and quite a few of the other African nations. And remember, Gaddafi had 140 tons of gold, lots of oil. Several other countries, of course, had minerals. They decided to come up with their own currency. It wasn't necessarily to battle the dollar, more of, hey, why shouldn't we have our, you know, there's a yen, there's a euro. Why can't Africa have its own currency, right? Why not? Not so fast.
But more speculation has been raised on the reasons for NATO's intervention in Libya. And
now remember, Saddam Hussein gassed his own people. We'll get to Assad later. Now we have the other thing. Gaddafi, another ruthless dictator who needs to be removed. This is only, what, a few years back. Remember, Libya is one of the countries on Wesley Clark's list. Interesting how the PNAC document literally shows you strategically, as in physically strategically, we need to be here, military base in this country, that we're there for, our bombers can reach, you know, this range. That's the military strategic reasons. But then you have the oil, the actual oil, natural gas. But then you have the land. And, you know, if you have an ocean here and land and you have a landlocked natural gas reserve, this is more what Syria is about. We'll get to that. Then from point A to point B, whatever that country is, they need to sign a document that says, yes, we will allow you to run a pipeline. We're going to get a piece of this action. Well, Assad said no. We'll get to that. So this one, the Libyan, remember, we checked them off that list. Libya was more about, and again, they had oil, and they're right there in North Africa, right on the Mediterranean. So they are both oil, gas, gold, and physically strategic to empire. So let's let this run. I know some of you have heard this, but again, the real reason we're doing what we're doing, and when I say we, I don't mean you and I mean the empire and the corporatocracy that runs and owns our empire, the banking system, the corporations, the oil companies, the real power, if you will, on the planet. Here we go again.
But more speculation has been raised on the reasons for NATO's intervention in Libya. And as RT's Laura Emmett reports, the organization may have been trying to prevent Gaddafi from burying the American buck.
According to some, it's about protecting civilians.
We must not tolerate this regime using military force against its own people.
Sound familiar? It's always the same reason. It's not, oh, we're an empire and we're going to take your shit, so we're going to come stomp you. Well, we can't say that because that's the honest reason we're doing this. That's the honest reason what's happening in Syria. And Clinton, Hillary, is all about that. And we'll get to their fucking foundation and how they're buying off third world dictators and funneling money the same way the mob washes money. It's the same thing. But this one was about a currency that could threaten the petrodollar.
Others say it's about oil.
The only reason they're interested in, with Libya, is about the oil. You'd think we'd be in Iraq if the major export there was broccoli.
But some are convinced intervention in Libya,
I don't know, I kind of like broccoli,
is all about currency. Specifically, Gaddafi's plan to introduce the gold dinar, a single African currency made from gold, a true sharing of the wealth.
It's one of these things that you have to plan almost in secret.
And he didn't. Yeah, well, I got this great idea. We're going to make this new gold and oil-backed currency, and I want to talk about it publicly. Omar, that's not a good idea. Does Saddam Hussein selling his oil in euros in 2000 ring a bell? Which is coming up here in a second. Which he didn't. Of course, he was threatening to do it.
It's another reason we got into Iraq, of course. Because, let this roll. Here we go.
As soon as you say you're going to change over from the dollar to the something else, you're going to be targeted. There were two conferences on this, one in 96 and another one in the year 2000, called the World Mataba Conference, organized by Gaddafi. And everybody was interested, and I think most countries in Africa were keen.
Gaddafi didn't give up. In the months leading up to the military intervention, he called on African and Muslim nations to join together to create this new currency that would rival the dollar and euro. They would sell oil and other resources around the world only for gold dinars. It's an idea that would shift the economic balance of the world. Countries' wealth would depend on how much gold they have, not how many dollars they trade. And Libya has 144 tons of gold. The UK has double that, but 10 times the population.
If Gaddafi had an intent to try to reprice his oil or whatever else the country was selling in the global markets and accept something else as a currency, or maybe launch a gold dinar currency, any move such as that would certainly not be welcomed by the power elite today who are responsible for controlling the world's central banks. So yes, that would certainly be something that would cause his immediate dismissal and the need for other reasons to be brought forth for removing him from power.
Powerful people, especially guys who can run a printing press at the Federal Reserve and print fiat currency that's backed by nothing other than trading oil. In other words, Venezuela wants to sell oil and they decide they're not going to sell it in the dollar, then that weakens the dollar. And as you'll hear here in a second, Saddam Hussein had threatened to do that.
It's happened before. In 2000, Saddam Hussein announced Iraqi oil would be traded in euros, not dollars. Sanctions and an invasion followed. Some say because the Americans were desperate to prevent OPEC from transferring oil trading in all its member countries to the euro.
The UK's gold is kept here.
So how much of this is about chemical weapons or conquering your own people or being brutal? You know what? Nothing. The PNAC document said this is how we're going to take over the world. These are the strategic countries. This is why they're strategic. This is how we'll keep the empire. And, you know, I live inside this empire. I want a benevolent empire. I want someone who's going to sign, go into an African country, Hillary fucking Clinton, and go, you know what? You've got a lot of minerals in those mountains, and we want to strike deals. We've got 10 different companies here that want to strike a deal with you. We want your country to benefit. We want your people to benefit. We'll benefit. You'll benefit. Everybody wins. That's the America that could be. But instead, we're fucking Darth Vader.
In a secure vault somewhere in the depths of the Bank of England. As in most developed countries, there's not enough to go around. But that's not the case in places like Libya and many of the Gulf states. A gold dinar would have given oil-rich African and Middle Eastern countries the power to turn around to their energy-hungry customers and say, sorry, the price has gone up and we want gold. Some say the US and its NATO allies literally couldn't afford to let that happen. Laura Emmett.
There you go. Oh, it gets worse. It's not just oil and gold. It's not just natural gas. You've heard from one four-star general. Let's hear from another.
If Afghanistan can become the Central Asian roundabout, to use President Karzai's term, to where it can be the new Silk Road, think of the implications for that.
This is Petraeus. Think he opened his mouth? Think they went after him right after it? You're not supposed to tell the people the truth. You're supposed to make them fear a religion, a third world country that could never threaten you, where people that are sheep herders and live in fucking tents and wouldn't harm you, don't care about you, don't know about you, don't have an internet, don't even know that 9/11 took place. But we on this side of the fence need to make, oh, they're the enemy. They're the bad guy. Why? Why are they the bad guy, General?
Recalling that, of course, Afghanistan is blessed with the presence of what are trillions, with an S on the end, trillions of dollars worth of minerals, if and only if you can get the extractive technology, the human capital operated, the lines of communication to enable you to get it out of the country and all the rest of that.
So we could probably, I don't know, maybe if we were the good country, we could go in and say, wow, you know, the people of Afghanistan, you're sitting on a ton of minerals in those mountains, and we're going to bring in these high-tech technologies, and a lot of these mineral companies are going to come in, and we're going to sign a treaty with you, and you're going to get, you know, your country, your standard living is going to go through the roof, because we're going to get the minerals that we need, to lithium or titanium, and making batteries, and you know, the world needs these minerals. I'm never going to deny that. How we get them, I'm never fucking satisfied. Not this way. Not this way.
Big if, and of course there's a foundation of security that would be necessary on which to build all of that. But again, the prospects are very significant if you can achieve objectives.
So there you go. Trillions with an S. Let's not even talk about the opium being grown. Let's not talk about the heroin epidemic. Let's not talk about the CIA and troops guarding all those poppies. The evil Taliban treats women like shit. I'll agree. Okay? But they are so religious, they're anti-drug. And before 9/11, they burnt all the poppies. They were... I mean, they're back ass backwards when it comes to how they treat women, and it's such a hardcore religion. But the one shining light was they didn't want their country hooked on opiates, and they certainly didn't want to be supplying opiates. And the opiate supply from Afghanistan, remember, it's perfectly the latitude and the longitude of Afghanistan, just the latitude and the elevation is perfect. The temperatures, everything is perfect for growing poppies. That's why it's strategic. If you could grow poppies anywhere, we wouldn't care. Or they, the CIA, which funds its black ops through this kind of stuff. They did it in the 60s and 70s. The crack cocaine epidemic of the 80s is directly connected to them as well. So like I said earlier, if the United States was what it could be, you know, there's corporations and there's powerful people, but we go, hey, you know, and we're going to get to the Clinton Foundation next here. First, we're going to find out about how they tried to bullshit us into the Sudan. Remember Kony, 2012? A propaganda piece that actually failed. But most of us were like, that's so bullshit. And it failed. So the Clintons, not just the Clintons, but that way of doing things went around the boogeyman. See, Kony was the new boogeyman. He's a new bad guy. He was like, we're going to send troops to Africa now. No, we don't. So how do we do it now? We'll get to that. But first, let's go to the original bullshit story of Kony. And then, of course, we'll get to Syria. And what Syria is really about is not Assad gassing his people. It's, remember, Syria was on that list of the seven countries. Syria is not as much oil rich as it is land strategically placed. But first, let's deal with that Kony bullshit to refresh your memory here.
All right. So according to the group's website, the group that makes this is called Invisible Children. Kony 2012 is a film and a campaign by Invisible Children that aims to make Joseph Kony famous, not to celebrate him, but to raise support for his arrest and set precedent for international justice. Now, most people agree that Joseph Kony is a very bad man. But the film advocates for more U.S. involvement and direct military action.
Sound familiar? It didn't work. So the Clintons are doing it elsewhere. Same. I mean, the Hegelian dialect. They do it over. And Saddam Hussein's a bad man. Muammar Gaddafi's a bad man. Assad's a bad man. Kony's a bad man. And it's never about them. Ever.
President Obama has already sent in 100 combat troops to try to help get rid of Joseph Kony, which is, in no uncertain terms, the U.S. government using resources to take down and possibly kill a man in another country. And we want to talk about some of the implications.
Some pretty badass soldiers. We only need 100 of you. What are you fighting, like 50 dudes? I do this podcast because I am firmly convinced that we as a species have so much potential that is unachieved. And the only way we get to that is truth. The only way we can change what's happening is to know what's wrong, what's what currently is taking place, and how you're being lied to, and how you're being manipulated. And you're being manipulated because you care. You care about the people of Syria, or you care about the people of Libya, or you care about the Iraqis. And those three evil bad men need to be removed or stopped. You care. And they'll show you a picture of kids with their arms chopped off or women laying there murdered. And they'll go, we need to do something. Incubator babies. Incubator babies. And the average American who's uninformed, who doesn't have a connection to the actual real flow of energy, information, they bite it like a bass hitting a frog. Over and over and over. Wake the fuck up. You know what? If you want to wake up, you will. If you don't, you won't. And the ones that don't are the issue. Because it's not because we can't find out the truth. It's not because I can't Google or go to YouTube and give you audio and information that absolutely proves you're being bullshitted again and again and again. It's not like the information's not there. The red pill intro I play is about choice. It's about what do you want? Do you want to know or do you not want to know? Take your blue pill, go back to bed. But don't you dare open your mouth to me and talk politics. Because you don't know shit. Well, I'm a liberal and I'm a conservative. No, you're asleep at the wheel. Coney. Couple more minutes of this. This is an interesting interview.
Patience of the release of this video and do some reading between the lines with war correspondent Keith Harmon Snow. Hey there, Keith. Let's talk about this. 70 million viewers and counting. Kony 2012 is already the fastest growing social media video campaign we've ever seen. Your thoughts on this?
Well, this is absolute propaganda, Christine. Not only is it full of lies, it's simplistic, and it's directing the American public to support further military action in Africa, where we are already there.
What are you say that this film is full of lies? What is not true about the film?
For example, that Kony has 30,000 children in his army. This is not true. Over the last 26 years of Kony's military actions against the government of Uganda, there have been supposedly 30,000 children abducted. Who abducted them is not clear because Museveni, the president of Uganda, is responsible for genocide in northern Uganda, and he needs Kony to be able to justify continuing U.S. support and military support and now sending in troops, which we've been doing for quite some time. So one of the lies in the film is that Kony is not supported by anyone. Kony has an office in Washington, D.C. The United States government has direct connections to Kony. If they wanted to get rid of this guy, they could get rid of him very quickly.
And this is part of this. Remember, 70 million views, and that was in a month. You know why? Because they're playing off our emotions, especially when we see a 10-year-old carrying an AK-47. We know intrinsically that war is wrong, but we definitely know that children fighting is unacceptable. And this media campaign, and that's exactly it. He called it pure propaganda. It failed. And it partially failed because most people are like, well, it's the middle of Africa, and what do I give a fuck? But it was more about, well, we're already in Iraq, we're already in Afghanistan. Libya was right on the preface. And people in America were like, okay, enough. We can't be everywhere all the time. So I think it was more of war fatigue as to why this failed and why this campaign, this propaganda campaign failed. But it had a lot to do with the fact this man wasn't seen Basically, think about these people that built this film and think about the reason they built it and think about the people that paid them to make it. And the people that paid them to make it had a reason for what? Military intervention in Africa. Why? We'll get to that with the Clinton Foundation. A couple more minutes here.
Are you telling me that in 2012, we don't have the sophisticated satellite technology to track down a single African warlord in Africa? Nonsense. Look at Jonas Savimbi the guy we supported, the CIA supported for years in Angola. As soon as the United States wanted him gone, he was gone within a week because the United States had Israel send in special forces and eliminate Jonas Savimbi. So Kony is kept there to serve the interests of the United States and to serve the interests of the Ugandan government, because as long as they have a bogeyman to claim is creating these atrocities, Museveni can shed the blame for the genocide against 2 million Acholi people onto this guy, Joseph Kony, and he can always ask the United States and the Pentagon for more military hardware, more aid, which is converted to military hardware, and more troops. And that's exactly what they've done.
I mean,
do you think if it's a bunch of desert sand that we'd give a shit? That we'd care? It's not about the rivers. It might be about some places rubber tree grows. Why? Why would we care about the Congo? Hillary Clinton's foundation cares. Bill Clinton's got some buddies there. Should I do the Clinton Foundation or Syria first? By the way, you know, I'm going to do Syria first here. Everybody talks about Hillary's emails and, you know, her own private server and the deletion of video of emails. Hardly anybody asks why. Why would you do that? Why would you want a private server? Why would you need your own private server? Now, granted, the NSA is monitoring everybody's email, everybody's phone. Hillary Clinton's Secretary of State. Why? Why would she try to go around the official government pipeline? Not the fact that she redacted or destroyed those emails. Not the fact that she had her own private server. Why? If I'm trying to communicate and do something illegal or immoral, and I need to send a message to the other people that are going to be part of that conspiracy with me, I don't want to go through an official channel. Too many people can see it, read it, copy it. Why did Hillary Clinton do that with her emails? Well, WikiLeaks has said, I have not seen the email yet. I Googled that crazy the other night. That some of this was about, of course, undermining Syria. They were on that list there. And why? Why Syria? Assad gassing his people, same old story, just like, you know, like the aforementioned boogeymen. Kony, boogeyman. Muammar Gaddafi, boogeyman. Saddam Hussein, boogeyman. Let's not forget Osama bin Laden and the box cutters, boogeyman. But why Syria? And why are they on that list? Why are they one of the seven countries that the PNAC document going all the way back to 99-2000 said we need to overturn this government, you know, the seven? Why? Why? It's because Hillary's emails, not all of them, but a lot of them, were those communications. They were the communique going, here's what we need to do. You know, here's what we took care of in Libya. Here's what we need to do in Syria. And those communications could not have taken place through normal channels, because there'd be too many people that can peek at him. So that's my theory. The whole reason for the private server, the whole reason for the deleted emails isn't, you know, people go like, oh, it's not technically illegal to do. I'm like, okay, you're sitting at the surface of what's going on, but go to why. Go to cause and effect. Why did she need the server to begin with? Syria is one of them. And here we go again. Assad gassed his people, or is Syria about something? And by the way, when you look at the pictures of what that country used to look like, And now it's just decimated, you know. God. Ugh. Those poor people. And so many of them gone into Europe now.
To strike again.
And so, I'm sorry. So many people have, oh, the damn Syrian refugees. You know, they talk about the effect. They don't talk about the cause. They talk about, oh, these damn Muslims infiltrating Europe. You ever ask yourself why? Well, let's do it again. Here we go. What is Syria about?
And now for more on the crisis in Syria, according to to President Obama and the war hawks in Congress, the U.S. needs to strike against Assad to enforce. And now for more on the crisis in Syria, according to President Obama and the war hawks in Congress, the U.S. needs to strike against Assad to enforce the international ban on the use of chemical weapons, to punish a brutal dictator for killing his people, and to show the world that America is going to stand up for its values. This is pretty much what the president said during a press conference in Sweden last week before heading to the G20 summit in Russia.
I do think that we have to act. Because if we don't, we are effectively saying that even though we may condemn it and issue resolutions and so forth and so on, somebody who is not shamed by resolutions can continue to act with impunity.
But for a war-weary American public, these arguments are falling on deaf ears. A new Pew Research poll has found that by more than 2-1, 63-28%, those surveyed say they are against U.S. military action against the Syrian regime for its reported use of chemical weapons against.
We're getting tired of the storyline. Because we're starting to recognize the bullshit. Even a hardcore conservative, even a neoliberal, even the people. And by the way, the moment Obama entered office, the anti-war protesters disappeared like a fart in the wind. Because when Bush was in office, they were everywhere. There were tens of thousands of people protesting Iraq and Afghanistan. Obama comes in. They disappear. So there are no war protesters anywhere in our country. There's a handful. Don't get me wrong. And there are people that are anti-war. And there are protests. But there was no opposition as in a large group of people going, no, no, no. What's wrong with diplomacy? What's wrong with negotiations? What's wrong with, you know, sitting down in a room with the leaders of five countries? And none of that takes place anymore. And according to this poll, we're so tired of it, we're against it, and it used to be if we invaded a country, Congress had this, the Constitution, the separation of powers. No, Obama was in office during Libya, and Obama is in office during this bullshit.
Civilians. And if the American people knew the real reasons behind Washington's push for a serious strike, they'd be even more opposed to the plan. For more on this, I'm joined now by Dr. Nafiz Ahmed, investigative journalist, contributor to The Guardian, and executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development. Dr. Ahmed, welcome to the...
By the way, this guy's been an amazing researcher. He's been one of the first people to do the same research a lot that other people looked into, kind of like what we're able to connect the dots here in 2016 about 9/11. This guy was doing back in 2003, 2004, and going, this isn't about Saddam Hussein. This is a conscientious, very smart person who's been a great researcher. And like just stated, he writes for The Guardian. And I'm going to let this roll because this is the real reason we're in Syria. Okay, we're going to get to Clinton and their foundation. And Africa, remember, Africa's next on the list. We'll get to that after this. How much bullshit can you cram into one podcast? And believe me, I don't lay awake at night anymore. I used to. I used to go, God, there's so much crap. We're lied to so often. It's just, does anybody care? Does anybody pay attention? Does anybody really care anymore? This video has 1,000 views on it.
1,000. And this video is the real reason we're in Syria right now. It has nothing to do with an evil dictator. How many have I mentioned? Kony, Saddam, Gaddafi, Bin Laden. That's 4. Assad is 5. And now we're going to listen to a man who's done his research.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of geopolitical and geostrategic issues at stake. And a lot of it is tied up with this long-term policy of sidelining Iran. But the fundamental thing that is linked to all of that, is this ongoing competition to dominate the energy corridors of the Middle East. This is basically about dominating the region's future oil and gas pipelines. And what we're seeing at play in Syria is actually a struggle not only involving the United States, United Kingdom and other powers, you know, Russia, but also regional powers like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Iran and others to basically try and control the positioning of Syria as a central player in where these energy corridors will end up.
They're showing a map right now, and you have the Caspian Sea, which is north of Iran. Okay, Iran's a big country, and over to the right is Turkestan or Turkey. Okay, to the left of Iran is Iraq, and then to the left of Iraq is Syria, and then of course the left to the left of Syria is the Mediterranean. And if you have the Caspian Sea, now we know the Caspian Basin is loaded. That whole basin, that whole, just not just the Caspian Sea, but everywhere around it is loaded with natural gas and oil. But it's landlocked. There's no way to, you can get to it, you can drill it, you can extract it from the land, but you can't transport it unless you go through Iran, or you go north of Iran, all the way around to Armenia and Turkey. By the way, Turkey is, of course, sitting on the Mediterranean as well. But the easiest way is to go through north Iran, northern Iraq, and through Syria. Well, we already control Iraq. Iran, that we've finally, we're not worried about. Have you noticed that we're not worried about their nuclear capability anymore? It's because they basically said, you want to run pipelines through the northern part of our country, sure, what's in it for us? And that was done, 3 years ago? But Assad said, no, you can't run a pipeline through us. Now, remember, Syrians and Russians are pretty tight. So now we have the boogeyman of ISIS. So we had 5 dictators, and now we have another boogeyman in ISIS, and ISIS is in Syria. Well, you know what's in Syria? Land. Land that goes to the Med. Pipelines need to go there. Oil companies, natural gas companies, mineral companies all need to not just extract that wealth from the land or under it, but they got to be able to transport it. And Syria is, that's why Syria is strategic. That's why they were one of the 7 countries in the PNAC document. They weren't necessarily oil rich, but they were geopolitically strategic. Now let it roll.
Going and who is going to benefit? And this kind of the process where this really began was in 2009, when Qatar basically had a proposal on the table for their own pipeline that would transport natural gas from their north field. The pipeline would go through Saudi Arabia, through Jordan, it would go through Syria, it would bypass Russia, crucially, and it would end up going through Turkey, where eventually it could supply gas to European markets. Now, Assad apparently turned this down because he didn't want to upset his Russian benefactors. Now, The following year, there was a new negotiations were speeding ahead for a new back pipeline project proposed by Iran, and Iran's proposal was to basically team up with Iraq. This pipeline would be linked to Iraq. It would go through Syria. It would end up supplying gas to Lebanon, and from there, it would potentially supply it could be extended further to supply European markets. Now, this pipeline was different, that it wouldn't bypass Russia. Oil or gas would be shipped from the Russian port of Tartus in Syria, where there's a big naval base. So what we see here is a very, very clear clear groundwork for competition, conflict, and all the rest of it. And we now know how important these pipeline projects were when we found out just a couple of weeks ago the Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, had these closed meetings with Russian President Putin, where he basically said, look, why don't you switch sides, stop supporting Assad, because, we're going to win the war. And when we win, we're going to control the outcome. And we're basically going to make sure that we can make sure that any regime that comes after that will not damage your gas interests and will not basically compete with your monopoly on supplying Europe's gas. But this was quite interesting because, a lot of people debate how important are these pipelines, is it something that will go to war? Well, clearly, the regional players find it very important.
Yeah. You mentioned Qatar wanting to run natural gas through there, Iran wanting to run oil and natural gas through there, Saudi Arabia, they wanted to run a pipeline up in competition with Qatar.
Hang on now. Got to back that up just a notch.
Arabia, they wanted to run a pipeline up.
Here we go.
Run natural gas through.
The regional players find it very important.
Now, remember, Iran was one of the seven countries on the list of regime change. We constantly heard about their centrifuges and them yellow cake in this, and they're going to be a nuclear power, blah, blah, blah. And suddenly, it wasn't an issue anymore. Well, Iran is the second largest oil reserves in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia is one, Iran is two, Iraq is three. Why did Iran, being this evil empire, suddenly not become important anymore? Listen to what he says about the countries that wanted the pipeline, because essentially Iran doesn't have to run it south for at least 1,000 miles. They can run, I think, just a tad through their country, the northern part of Iraq and Syria. Listen to what he says here.
Yeah. You mentioned Qatar wanting to run natural gas through there, Iran wanting to run oil and natural gas through there, Saudi Arabia, they wanted to run a pipeline up in competition with Qatar. I understand that it was like almost a battle between these two countries over who was going to control the new regime in Syria if they were able to pull that off. Do I have that right?
Absolutely, yeah. All of these powers have their own specific interests. But I think what's interesting from our perspective is to kind of see, where did the United States, where did Britain, where did they fit into this picture?
Yeah, well,
it's pretty clear.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
Well, I was going to ask if perhaps Iraq had something to do with that. I mean, some of the most profitable oil in the world right now, because these are relatively virgin fields, are in the western oil fields of Iraq. And that western border of Iraq is the eastern border of Syria. Although Iraq has essentially become an ally of Iran now, I mean, what's going on with all of this stuff? Because Iraq was supposed to be our guy, right?
Absolutely. It looks like, despite the Iraq war and everything, it's been very difficult for the U.S. and the U.K. to maintain their control of what is happening in the region. And the biggest fear of all, this is something that keeps recurring. If you look at the various defense planning documents and strategy documents and policy papers coming out of Washington and London, one of the biggest fears is the unification of a lot of these Shia regimes. So you've got the Iraq regime, you've got Iran, and then you've got Syria. Syria is Alawite, and Alawites are a minority strain, not really considered part of the Shia strain, but they certainly swing more towards that side than they do the Sunnis. So effectively, you've got these three states in the region planning to team up and basically divert their natural resources to other powers for their own for their own benefit or for the benefit
but
of
then the
essentially not for the benefit of the United States or the United Kingdom and the West.
Right.
So this is
okay, that's the people you're fighting against that are saying, wait a minute, this is our land. What about us? Why do we have to eat dirt for a living when you need our land to run a pipeline or you need our land to pump our oil? What about us? People say, why are we fighting in the Middle East? I'm like, you're fighting the people that live there, the indigenous populations, the sovereign countries, and the people that say, what about us? What do we get from this? It's not some religious war. It's simply the same thing as if you lived in Georgia and someone in Kentucky and South Carolina wanted to run a pipeline through your state, and you would go, okay, yeah, well, what do we get? It's the same thing. It's not some religious jihad. It is simply people going, oh, okay, Americans or Europe wants Iraqi or Iranian oil, and they want to run a pipeline through our country of Syria. What about us? That's what these wars are about. A couple more minutes here, and then I'm going to come back. The podcast can be a little shorter this week, but I'm going to remind you of some things that I hope are as important to you as they are to me.
This is a very, quite a worrying phenomenon. And one of the key issues for the United States in the Middle East is really maintaining access to regional oil and gas supplies. And the key to doing that is maintaining the stability of the Persian Gulf states. And obviously that includes Iraq. That also includes Saudi Arabia, includes Qatar. And this is something that is repeatedly described in you know, declassified documents that have come out. Is this very important role of maintaining these Gulf countries, because that's where they understand that for the foreseeable future, we'll get most of the oil and gas coming from that will stabilize world oil supply, stabilize world oil prices.
So
it was very important for them to ensure that they maintain this the domination of these countries in the region. What we see here is this shift towards these recalcitrant Shia regimes that are kind of outside the system. They don't really play ball. They don't like the rules. They want to do things their own way, and it was messing things up.
Again, what about us? You know, we have those people here in America. You know, some of them are called constitutionalists, people that kind of go like, "Yeah, you want to extract a bunch of minerals from our state, but what does the state get? If you make a dollar for every ton of something you extract, then shouldn't our state get 10 cents or 20 cents on the dollar?" They're not necessarily crazy, wacko, biblical, or you know, just Islamic crazies. They're actually people that see the geopolitical things taking place all around themselves and are simply saying, and dot, 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 what's in it for us? Now, I don't think that's being greedy. I certainly don't think that's being tyrannical. I think that's being someone who's paying attention to everything that's going around, and these are the ones fighting. Now, you have factions fighting themselves. You have religious differences. You have all of those things factored in, and that's how you destabilize, by the way. When you want to destabilize a country, you get rid of a guy like Saddam Hussein, who kept three different factions separate from each other, from fighting each other. And he was tyrannical doing that. Gaddafi a little bit, Assad a tiny bit, but for the most part, for the lack of a better phrase, as even Donald Trump has said, they were better off before we went there. But if you want to destabilize a country, I said this to someone on Facebook, and you want to pick their pocket, you need a third distraction. You're going to pick their pocket, but a little kid's going to bump into them. Sorry, sir. Boom, all of a twist. You're going to pick their pocket. And that's what ISIS is. They're the new boogeyman, or the seventh boogeyman. That's what we got going on. Okay, that's enough of that. Now we're going to get to the Clinton Foundation. And by the way, Hillary Clinton, evil. Donald Trump, buffoon. That's how I feel about this dog and pony show, just so you know. But we're going to start. This is a piece of a documentary called Clinton Cash. Now, a lot of people say, she gets $250,000 to speak to a bank, those kind of things. And it's true. It's traceable. And, if someone's dumb enough to pay her that kind of money, those banks also donate to her campaign because they know she won't hold them accountable because since her husband in 97 removed Glass-Steagall, which meant commercial banking and investment banking, which were always had a wall between them, were separate. In other words, the investment banks couldn't get to your savings account, and Clinton made Glass-Steagall, two different congressmen that decided a while ago that we need a little wall for the safety of the American investor and the American teacher who puts away her savings account. Bill made that go away. People have asked Hillary about, do you want it back? Should we reinstate it? No, not at all. So now we have the Clinton Foundation. Now, if this was a foundation that was out there taking millions of dollars and parachuting seeds and this water distillation and solar energy products to third world countries, and you'd say, wow, they're really doing their best to help those people empower themselves to lift themselves out of pure, starvation to at least the fact that they didn't have to walk 10 miles to a pond and carry a bunch of mosquito-laden water back to. In other words, if a foundation with hundreds of millions of dollars is actually going to help third world countries, I'm all for it. Now we're going to spend the next 5 to 8 minutes and find out what the Clinton Foundation's really about.
Africa is a continent that has been a chamber of horrors for decades. It's really not the fault of the African people. It's largely a result of the kind of system that's been perpetuated there. You have these oligarchs which dominate these countries that oftentimes have natural resources that can be very lucrative. And these oligarchs strike deals with foreign corporations or foreign governments who, in effect, prop them up and put them in power. And in exchange, these oligarchs give these entities access to rich mineral deposits.
Think about that for a second. Let's just pick an African country randomly, look and go, wow, look at the mineral reserves. Not so much oil or natural gas, but look at the lithium or the titanium or the silver or the gold. Oh, my God, we want that. We want it. How can we get in there? You just can't parachute in, blow everybody away. That's why I played the Coney thing. That was the boogeyman. They were going to try to use the same old issue. Oh, here's your bad guy. Let's send in a bunch of troops. Meanwhile, we're going to take their shit. Didn't work. Clinton's decided we can do it differently.
And the Clintons, you would expect to be opposed to this sort of thing, and that's at least what their language does.
Our countries have deepened our cooperation on many issues, including,
listen to this bitch,
including good governance and transparency, energy, regional security, and advancing peace and development in the Niger Delta.
The problem is, their words are different from their actions.
Rwanda has clearly taken an impressive trajectory of development.
Okay, Rwanda has really taken an impressive trajectory of development, and the people here still think, I know, I'm translating here because his accent.
And the people here still think Kagame is the man.
And they really think Gaddafi is the man to take them to another level. That's the leader.
Them to another level.
President Paul Kagame has walked all around the crowd, thanking the people for electing him unopposed as chairman of the RPF for president.
Gaddafi has been elected unopposed. I won! It's like playing basketball against yourself. I won! Unopposed. 7 more years, by the way.
Gotta be up for another 7-year term.
But his critics say that far from entrenching democracy.
Okay, he's far from democratic. Critics say he's far from changing democracy in Rwanda. He's actually eroding it. You can't hear this. This is why I got to translate it.
In Rwanda, he's actually eroding it by silencing his opposition.
By silencing his opposition. You call that democracy? I don't. Clintons think it is. They don't think it is. They know it's not. They're just playing the game.
Paul Kagame has been praised by Bill Clinton and the Clinton Foundation. But the fact of the matter is Paul Kagame has a terrible human rights record. He's accused of aiding military operations in the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, and that actually forced the recruitment of child soldiers. The UN has identified him as being involved in activities that entailed massive human rights violations.
The newer opposition parties that have been formed.
Opposition parties that have been formed, and I think you can hear her. Her accent's not too bad.
In the last year or two, have one by one been silenced or otherwise excluded from the race. And individuals, not only politicians, but even journalists, for example, and other Rwandans who may have views different from those of the government, have found themselves at the receiving end of what has become quite a violent campaign of intimidation.
People fighting back for their own rights, their own land, their own nation. And not only that, the reporters or media people, in other words, probably more of the local news reporter who's saying, oh, this is so out of balance. This is not democracy. There is corruption. Those people are facing, she uses the word intimidation. Picture intimidation in Africa. You've seen, you've heard about it. If you want to make an effect, you want to scare people from speaking out, do you put a bullet in them or do you machete them? How do you set an example when you're trying to install fear into people? That's what's going on here. And the Clintons, they're supporting the man who's supporting that behavior.
Intimidation.
Well, Paul Kagame is a friend of Bill Clinton's.
I want to say a special word of appreciation for the leadership of President Kagame.
I'm greatly
fuck you, Billy Boy,
to receive this Clinton Global Citizen Award.
He's actually given awards by Bill Clinton for his conduct as the leader of that country, and they regale him as a great military leader. This is the sort of legitimization that we don't want of these kinds of dictators and leaders. That's the kind of legitimization that the Clintons have engaged in. And they've done it in a way that creates commercial opportunities for donors and friends and allies.
Commercial opportunities. I'm going to play Glenn Greenwald at the end of this. Because they'll, you know, just watch John Oliver the other night give her a hall pass. So you can't prove anything that the Clinton Foundation has done is illegal. Keep that in mind. We'll get back to that.
Who want to do business in Africa?
God. By the way, while this music's playing, they're showing vultures picking apart a carcass.
Business in Africa means you're dealing with dictators who are going to give you access to, say, mineral rights or oil drilling rights, but you're going to have to pay them off. The Clintons partner with foreign entities who want access to Africa. and specifically mining companies or energy companies who need to get concessions for access to oil or natural gas or the rights to mine for gold.
The Clintons are the middleman. They are the laundry. Money flows into the Clinton Foundation. That money goes to the evil dictators. Those evil dictators allow the big business, miners, and everything you're hearing about to come in. The Clinton Foundation is not all warm and fuzzy. It's not about, oh, feeding starving children. It's about big business, corporatization of Africa, and, oh, yeah, by the way, the Clintons make just a bit on the side. I said it at the beginning of this podcast. It's all warm and all. We have a foundation and we care about people. Fuck you. You're scum. You're scum.
Those two make a powerful alliance because these companies will give money to the Clintons, either in the form of speaking fees or in the form of donations to the Clinton Foundation. And the Clintons will then, in effect, do their bidding before the halls of power and corridors of power in Africa. And they will go to foreign governments and encourage them to do business with individuals who are putting money in their pocket. And this leads to some amazing fits of behavior that, in a way, are just reminiscent of 19th century colonialism.
A perfect example of this is Ambassador Joe Wilson. Joe Wilson is a longtime friend of the Clintons. In fact, he endorsed Hillary Clinton in the 2008 presidential election. And it was also thought that he might become a senior official in Hillary Clinton's State Department. But the fact of the matter is Joe Wilson was up to something far more nefarious during Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State. In 2009, shortly after she became Secretary of State, when Wilson was the vice chairman of a company called Jarch Capital, they took out a 50-year lease on 400,000 hectares in South Sudan. South Sudan was in the middle of a civil war, and this lease was actually signed with warlords who were involved in the civil war.
They leased a whole bunch of land during a conflict. Warlords being what we would call, depends. If you're on the side of the Clintons, you call them revolutionaries. If you're on the side of the people who actually care about their own land, their own, hey, what about me, that kind of thing, they're warlords. They are the muscle that we couldn't, the Coney thing failed. We couldn't use U.S. military might muscle because it would have been far too obvious in Africa. We did it in the Middle East. But now we're letting the local, quote, warlords, unquote, do our bidding for us. When I say us, I mean the corporatocracy, and crush the locals. You want to know why a 12-year-old's carrying a gun? Because that's all the hope they have. That kid is an insurgent trying to keep the warlord and the Clintons and the mining companies and the gold companies and the oil companies from steamrolling their world. And it's all so warm and fuzzy. These people are fucking assholes.
These individuals who are engaged in massive human rights violations, including the massacre of opponent tribes. And basically what Joe Wilson was engaged in was something called investing in sovereignty changes. They were basically cutting deals.
Investing in sovereignty changes. Isn't it funny? George Carlin talks about euphemisms all the time. You know, toilet paper becomes bathroom tissue. Investing in sovereignty changes. Colonialism, corporatism, crushing people. Empire, nation building. But no, it's we're going to invest in sovereignty changes. Couple more minutes of this, then Glenn Greenwald, and then my closing comments.
Lucrative deals worth potentially hundreds of millions of dollars with these warlords. And the expectation was simple. These warlords would take power, then they would give them access to these lands where they could make huge amounts of money exploring for natural gas, exploring for oil, and for mineral rights. Ambassador Joe Wilson isn't the only Clinton friend and foundation donor who was working in war-torn countries. Swedish mining investor Lucas Lundin has pledged $100 million to the Clinton Foundation.
It's just, I got $100 million. I'm going to give it to the Clintons. They're going to give it to the warlords. The warlords are going to take over the country, and then we're all going to go in and just rape. And I don't mean that physically, but I mean the land.
But when you call it the Clinton Foundation...
Oh, that's so beautiful. They're helping people.
Believe me, I don't lose sleep over this. Because I know powerful people want more power, and they don't give a shit how they get it. They could care less. But when the woman who's running for president is part of this, and people look up to her and say she's going to be a great leader... And they don't even want to think about this. Again, her emails about Syria were about undermining Syria. I played you that audio. It's about pipelines. It's not about Assad. Now, the Clinton Foundation is murdering people directly. Well, we'll give this guy, well, you give us $100 million. We'll keep 20 of it. We'll give $80 million to the murderers. The murderers will crush any competition. Once the competition's done, and what I mean by competition is, I mean, what about me, the person who lives there? Me and my father have had this 100 acres since, 200 years ago. I know there might be gold and oil or minerals under that land, but what about me? Why not sign a treaty? Why not we win, you win? No, it's just easier to fucking kill you.
He did that in 2007, and his most lucrative mining operations are in the war-torn country of the Democratic Republic of Congo. This is a country that perhaps has the most horrific human rights situation on the face of the earth. By the time Lucas Lundin made his $100 million pledge to the Clinton Foundation, his Congo operation was making, quote, staggering profits, end quote, according to his own financial statements. His overall capitalization was $20 billion. But for those profits to remain staggering, U.S. policy under...
They gave $100 million and made $20 billion. He gave the Clintons $100 million to do the dirty work, and he made $20 billion. Let it sink in. You want to be part of this? No, I don't.
Hillary Clinton had to remain unchanged. That's a problem. Hillary Clinton, as a senator back in 2006, supported something called the Congo Relief Security and Democracy Promotion Act. As the law's name implied, the goal was to bring reform to Congo. That's not something that Lucas Lundin would want. So in 2009, when Hillary became Secretary of State, she reversed course 180 degrees and went from supporting reform in Congo to supporting the status quo, which is exactly what Lucas Lundin would want, who, of course, had committed $100 million to the Clinton Foundation. But Congo isn't the only scandal-plagued country where Clinton benefactors have made millions.
Africa's most populous nation, Nigeria, is full of promise. But fulfilling that promise is sometimes a struggle. Plagued by corruption and mismanagement, the resource-rich country has a poverty rate of over 50%.
Look at a country like Nigeria, which is really a cesspool of corruption. In fact, people will say it is perhaps the most corrupt country in the world. It's rich in natural resources. It produces a lot of oil. But that money never trickles down to the people. It goes to the oligarchs who run the country, who oftentimes take that money and put it in Swiss bank accounts in a way that, of course, the people of Nigeria can never benefit from. And you see, there's a federal law in the United States which says if foreign governments that receive U.S. assistance aren't transparent in how they spend that money, that they will not be able to get U.S. foreign assistance anymore. It's about transparency. But there's a way around that law. You can get a waiver from that law. How? By getting the U.S. Secretary of State to grant you a waiver.
Can't call her Dr. Evil. She's not a doctor. But this woman, who many people, I was a conservative my whole life. My daddy voted Republican. I'm going to vote Republican. You know, over there on the right now, you got people like, oh, I've been a liberal my whole life. And Hillary Clinton's about women's rights and blah, blah, blah. By the way, next week we'll do Trump. I am not choosing sides in this catastrophe. I'm just pointing out the truth. That's what we do. That's why the show is called Dangerous Conversation, not Popular Conversation. If you can't see what this woman's been about, is about, and will be about, fuck you. Stop listening to my show. Go away. I'd rather have 4 listeners than 40,000 assholes. A couple more seconds of this, then Glenn Greenwald, and then we'll close it up.
We intend to remain very supportive on your reform efforts. Thank you for mentioning the work we did together on the elections. We're also very supportive of the anti-corruption reform effort. It's more transparency and the work that you and your team is also.
See, I can call her a cunt because of her behavior, not because she's a female. I can't call Donald Trump a cunt. Maybe we should. Maybe cunt should just be a universal phrase to say, you know what? Like they use it in Australia, like Jeffries, the comedian, does. You know? He's a fucking cunt. Well, she's a fucking cunt.
So championing, because we really believe that the future for Nigeria is limitless.
This woman's going to be president of the United States of America. It's just so sad. And the reason it's sad, and I'll get to that after Glenn here. Is what we could be versus what we are. And that's what bums me out. Not what's taking place, just what if, you know? There's so many good people in the world, so many good-hearted people. And I'll address that in a second. Glenn Greenwald here for about 2 minutes is going to discuss the difference between what Clinton and the foundation does versus the, quote, whether it's illegal, like John Oliver defended her the other night on his show on HBO. And I'm going to let it roll. It's only 2 minutes, and I'll be back with my closing statements. Here we go.
And so here you have Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton having this Clinton Foundation with billions of dollars pouring into it from some of the world's worst tyrannies like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and Qatar and other Gulf states, other people who have all kinds of vested interest in the policies of the United States government. And at the same time, in many cases, both Bill and Hillary Clinton are being personally enriched by those same people, doing speeches for many hundreds of thousands of dollars in front of them, at the same time that she's running the State Department, getting ready to run for president, and soon will be running the executive branch. And so the primary defense of Democrats, which is, look, there's no proof of a quid pro quo. Yes, Hillary Clinton did things that benefited these donors, but you can't prove that the reason she did them is because she got the Clinton Foundation got this money or her husband got this money. This is an absurd standard. That has been the Republican argument for many years. Of course, you can't prove a quid pro quo because you can't get into the mind of somebody and show their motives. That was the argument of Antonin Scalia and John Roberts in Citizens United and Anthony Kennedy. They said, look, you can't prove that big money donations are corrupting. Maybe it creates an appearance of it, but you can't prove it. And so the problem here is that the Clintons have essentially become the pioneers of eliminating all of these lines, of amassing massive wealth from around the world and using that to boost their own political power, and then using that political power to boost the interests of the people who are enriching them in all kinds of ways. And of course, questions need to be asked and suspicions are necessarily raised, because this kind of behavior is inherently suspicious and it needs a lot of media scrutiny and a lot of attention. And I'm glad it's getting that.
My show has never been about leaning. I guess I could say I'm socially liberal, because I am. It's my body, my belief systems. Don't you dare poke your nose in it. Conservatively, I don't know, maybe we could spend half what we spend on the military. That's, believe me, wishful thinking. And take that and actually put it towards people and progress and prosperity. But there's a reason I've been an independent since I was 18. It's because even back then, I saw through a facade of money grabbing, backroom dealings from people who don't care about you. They play on your emotions and they're good at it. And you care. So when you vote and you lean left or you lean right, your passion is authentic, and I always respect that. And you want to think that your guy or your girl or whatever is going to, you know, make things better. I understand that. I always feel that. But then reality sets in. And the reality is, as George Carlin would say, they don't care about you. They never have. They never will. They make you think they will. They make you think they do. The reason I have an issue with everything that's gone on in those seven countries in 5 years and what's going on in Africa now is because I see the pictures, man. I see the pictures of crushed cities, just rubble. People drinking water that's full of disease. And only a few years earlier, there was a little bit of prosperity in their lands, but they were sitting on top of oil or natural gas, or they wanted their own currency. And our empire, not America. See, America to me is its people, it's the Constitution, it's things that matter, it's empathy, it's caring, it's a helping hand. But that's not America anymore, at least not on the global scale. America's just one big giant steamroller. And these are the people that don't care about who gets crushed under the steamroller. They just want their power, their growing empires, their mini empires. You know, Bill and Hillary have an empire, and then they're built on an empire that's built on an empire and all the way up the top of the food chain. And the reason I still want to do Dangerous Conversation is to inspire you to think about things, look into things. But are you satisfied with the pictures of war? Are you satisfied with 2-year-olds, 4-year-olds, and 8-year-olds laying dead in their parents' arms? Are you fucking happy with that? Are you so-called Christian? Are you so-called American? However you label yourself and the group you want to put yourself in, you think that's the best we can do? You think that's the best humanity can honestly do? I don't. I picture There's so much energy on the planet, and that trickles down to every nation and every population. I picture the so-called religions of the world all admitting to each other publicly that God might have many faces, identities. I don't know, I just, the thing I think about at night, I don't lay awake, I don't worry about it, because these monoliths and these out-of-control dynasties are very powerful. And I don't know if one revolution in one country or some type of change will change things. I can't say for certain, but I do know that I personally can picture in my mind a far more sustainable planet, populations, energy uses, not treating our oceans as a sewer. I can picture a society that is far more balanced. It'll never be perfect. It'll never be pure utopia. But I can picture way better than we're fucking doing. A 10-year-old can do that. Give him some crayons and say, draw me a beautiful planet. And what they'll draw is a bunch of people holding hands of different colors and races and religions. You know what? That 10-year-old can envision more than this crap that we're led as leaders. We poison our water. We dump toxic chemicals into our oceans. We treat the planet like a big old garbage disposal. We kill. There are about 4 million dead Muslims since 2000. Is that the best we can do? Because in my life, and it ain't perfect, I've been trying to say, you can do better, Scott. You can do better. Fix this. Correct this. Try to change this. Apologize here. Atone here. In my own personal life, I'm pushing myself to try. I expect the same thing from mankind. I expect the same thing from so-called leadership. Stop being conned. Have the guts and the balls to look into what is really the truth about things. And first, you're going to do yourself a favor. Maybe you believe yourself as a spiritual being. Maybe you don't. But you know, at the end of the day, at the end of your life and your deathbed, you're going to go on. You know what? I stood for what was right. I cared about people. I cared about injustice. I cared that so much that it kind of infiltrated a few people around me. And maybe they had that same effect. The domino effect. And the show I just did for you shows you over and over again that it's not about people. It's not about happiness. It's not about prosperity. It's about giant, powerful corporations, people, banks, governments, literally stepping on the rest of us like we're a bug on a sidewalk. And it's unacceptable. We can do a lot better. I hope you know that. Because I do. I picture an advanced society where communication and information is transparent, where there are no more resource wars, where resources are reused, recycled, where we grab the amazing amount of sunlight, geothermal energy, wind energy, tidal energy, and so many people are prospering that when I hopefully reincarnate into that world, that it's beautiful. I hope you want that too, because I do. Always remember, knowledge is power. Empower yourself with something that is closer to the truth and you will do yourself a personal favor, and you will do the world a bigger favor. I am absolutely convinced of that. We don't live in caves anymore. We don't have to stab animals with spears to be alive. But between what's going on with chemicals, artificial farms, they're pulling our power away from us, and we need to re-empower ourselves. I hope you enjoyed tonight's show, and I hope it resonates with you. And if it does, keep listening. If it doesn't, and you need to go back into your left-leaning or right-leaning world, then you know what? See you later. Don't need you. Don't want you. You're not about making things better. You're about, I need to be right. You guys have a great night, and I will talk to you again next week on Dangerous Conversation.
Beach Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
So Uber, right? Mm-hmm. Our favorite way to get around drunken, you know, all whatever, every weekend, has now, you know, Uber Eats is this food delivery service.
Okay.
So
here
instead of like picking you up at your house,
yeah,
they're just going to
drop the food
off food for you.
I thought this happened a while ago. This just happened?
I think it just happened in our area recently.
Okay, because I've been hearing about it in the news. Maybe it finally, okay. So, all right, I'm liking this.
So there's also Drinkly, which is the service that delivers liquor to your...
Drinkly,
yeah.
I like this. Oh, yeah.
Have you not used I think it's Drinkly, yeah.
No, I haven't used it. No. I got a Publix like a block away.
No. Well, see, this is for like people that don't want to leave their couch.
Yeah.
Like for Sunday afternoon around 3 or 4 o'clock when you're glued I'm screwed. So you get on your apps. Now we have Uber Eats that delivers food to our house, and we have Drinkly, which delivers the booze to our house.
I love this.
I don't understand why we're leaving our homes anymore.
Yeah. Why go to the game? That's why I don't leave the house anymore.
No.
You don't want to go to the game because fuck that. It's too hot. It's too expensive.
No.
You sit at home and watch it. It's a better experience at home. And now that I didn't even have to go to the store to get wine or beer or anything. It's like, oh, it's over. I'm done.
Yeah. I think that's the way the world's going, though.
Oh,
where we don't have to leave our bed or sofa all day long.
Great.
We work from home.
Yep.
We work on our phones.
Yeah.
We have food delivered to us.
Oh, this sounds so good. Why would you ever want to deal with another person again?
No. If you got to go somewhere, you get an Uber. It's super cheap.
Yep.
I mean,
I like
I don't
it.
Know.
What about, so how long does it say? I wonder how long it takes for the Uber food.
It's
like,
not long.
The Uber cab, like, it's there in 5 minutes.
Right. It depends on how close you are to the restaurant. So it has, like, just tracks your phone,
right,
and it says it'll give you the delivery time. So, like, the place near my house was only, you know, 15, 20 minutes.
And if I'm an Uber driver, I'm definitely doing the Uber food instead of the Uber people. Why would you want to have people in your car when you can have food?
Just drop
you
off
could
food.
Sneak in a couple fries.
Right?
You could do whatever. And, like, you don't have to deal with people.
Yeah.
You don't have to deal with drunks throwing up in your car.
Yeah.
And just assholes and just with everything, all the pitfalls that come with being an Uber driver.
Mm-hmm.
You can just, you know, deliver food.
I think it's a great idea.
Good for Uber. All right.
I should be an Uber. No, I shouldn't be an Uber Eats driver.
How much? Seriously, I would be 400 pounds if I got that job.
Yeah. I would too.
That's
But that, how cool would it be? You get to go into, like, every single, you know, pretty popular restaurant in town. You get to know everybody quickly.
It's true. Yeah.
You know, hey, what's a special tonight?
Would you would you grab a couple fries out of the
grab a couple fries?
I would.
Throw in an extra side for me while I'm standing here waiting for the food?
Yeah, why not?
I would weigh 400 pounds.
Totally. Because you're going to build that relationship with all the restaurants, and you'll get the hookup. You get the extra soup or whatever. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that'd be good.
I think that's a good idea.
On the Beach can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and RadioInfluence.com.